All right, so how about this? A deep sigh today of relief. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Wednesday, today, 26 Feb. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Setting aside, for now, anyway, the risk of hyperventilating with all those deep breaths and sighs of relief I've been taking as Wall Street decides what it thinks about the coronavirus, this was, relatively speaking, a more sedate day in global equities. But there is a stock market story to be told about the way the White House is talking about COVID-19. Neil Irwin is the senior economics correspondent for the New York Times, writing about this very thing in his column today. Neil, it's good to have you back.
Thanks for having me, Kai.
So this is, macroeconomically speaking, a story of risk in the global economy. It is also now, for the president, a very personalized risk, this touting he has done of the stock market.
That's right. We've had 3 years of President Trump saying the stock market is all about me. I've driven it up. I'm the reason your portfolio is doing well. So that leaves him more vulnerable than most presidents would be if we see a real continued sell-off, not just the couple of days we've had this week, but a sustained kind of bear market would be very bad for this president in particular.
Were this a different administration, what do you suppose would be happening?
You know, I think we'd see even more briefings than we have been getting from public health authorities. We'd see a sense of caution, a sense that, you know, you don't want to rush ahead and say that either everything is solved or, you know, it's time to go and buy stocks. There certainly wouldn't be this much emphasis on the stock market. There would be emphasis on the underlying problem of a potential health public health catastrophe. And I think that's what's unusual about how the Trump administration is handling this. They're so laser focused on the stock market because the president is laser focused on the stock market. Right now, that's not really the first order thing we need to be worrying about.
You make the analogy in your column this morning to a private company having a safety recall crisis of some kind.
Yeah. Imagine a company, they have a product that gets people sick or causes problems. They have to recall it. And the question is, what do you want the executive team to be spending their time doing? You don't want them going on TV and yelling about the stock price. What you want is them to deal with the problem, figure out how to fix that product. You know, that's what you want out of a private company. The same is true of the government. You want the government to do everything it can to try and minimize this problem, save lives, and prevent disruption to supply chains and business activity, even as the disease does spread.
That brings up this question of toolkit, which we usually talk about as it relates to the Federal Reserve, right? What can the Fed do? And certainly monetary policy is the biggie for the Fed. And we will hear at some point from Jay Powell on this the next time he chooses to speak publicly. What about fiscal policymakers? I mean, if they were sitting there, they are sitting there, but what might we think that they should be doing?
Well, I think the central problem with this is that if we get major supply disruptions, it's not something that either monetary or fiscal policy is very well suited to deal with. So, yeah, we might get an interest rate cut out of the Fed. Maybe you get some kind of stimulus package out of Congress, a cut in the payroll tax, something like that. That would help put money in people's pockets. That would help boost the stock market. But it's not going to solve the underlying problem. And if there aren't goods being shipped from China and other countries, if U.S. factories have to shut down, if airlines have empty planes, empty hotels, those things can't be solved by flooding the zone with more money. And that's what's worrying about this. If this does lead to some kind of protracted economic downturn, it'll be hard to get out of it.
Neil Irwin, senior economics correspondent for The New York Times. Neil, good to talk to you as always. Thanks.
Thanks so much, Kai.
On Wall Street today, still more down than up, just not as drastically as I alluded to. We will have the details when we do the numbers. For the past week or so on this program, we have been introducing you to 10 people making a go of it in this economy. 10 people who, when taken together, form a kind of representative sample of the American labor force as a whole. Our project, turning data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics about the 164 million people in the labor force into real people that we could talk to. Details and methodology for this deconstruction of the labor force on our website, marketplace.org/work, of course. But here on the radio, today the next installment in the series we're calling The United States of Work.
There's always things that you don't like about your job.
You work hard for what you want.
You know, every job has their ups and downs.
Whatever good job means.
I like the hustle. I like working fast.
It's not a career. It's a lifestyle.
Yesterday, we introduced you to Kate Bellino, age 24. She works for a bank in Centennial, Colorado. Today, we're sticking with the official category that Kate falls into, sales and office occupations. But we're going across the country and across generations, too.
My name's Gail Gray Harrell. I work part-time at Royal Farms Convenience Store.
In?
In Loudoun County, Virginia.
A suburb, basically, of Washington, D.C. That place she works, Royal Farms?
It's like a 7-Eleven, but Royal Farms is famous for their fried chicken.
Aha.
So when you come out, you'll have to have some.
Of course we will. What do you do there?
I guess, called customer service. When we're not busy, I kind of piddle through the store. I clean up the magazines. Mostly my main job is to wait on customers, talking to them, hearing about whatever. I think I like meeting people.
You sound like a person who's really social.
That's what people say. Yeah, my name sometimes is the social butterfly.
Gail is 70, going on 71, and has been working this part-time job at Royal Farms, where she makes about $12 an hour, for the past 2 years. Workers like her, the ones over the age of 55, make up one of the fastest-growing parts of the labor force. And one big reason that Gail is still working?
I like to travel. I like to go, and that's my extra pocket money.
Yeah.
My gas money, you know, the nails, the extra stuff that would come out of your check.
Tell me about the career you had before you started Royal Farm, right? Because you were doing a thing for 20-something years.
Yeah, I worked for USAA Insurance Company for 29 years.
That's my insurance company, for the record. Just got
that disclosure.
All right,
you know about us then.
I do indeed. Mm-hmm. I do indeed. What'd you do for them?
I was a claims adjuster, auto claims adjuster. Let's clarify that.
Was that a good job for 29 years?
I guess so. I was there 29 years, yes.
Yeah.
You know, every job has their ups and downs, so... Sure, it was a good job, all jokes aside.
Why'd you leave? I mean, was it just time to retire?
I took it early out because the office that I was in, which is in Reston, Virginia, they were closing down and moving to Virginia Beach, Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
You had an option of taking it early out or moving, so I took it early out.
So you took the early out, and then what'd you do?
I worked for an independent agency for about a year and a half. Took some more time off, then I worked for JetBlue for almost 5 years. And after that, I moved to Florida with a friend.
And now you're back up in Virginia? How'd that happen?
I got a little grandbaby that brought me back, granddaughter.
Grandbabies will do that to you.
Yes.
So you live with your son now, right? And the grandbaby?
I live with my son. Grandbaby goes between mama and daddy.
Do you think this economy is working for you? I mean, between whatever you get from Royal Farm and your time at USAA, you got enough money to get by?
I do, living with my son. Now, if I were on my own, no, not in Loudoun County. It's very expensive to live here in Loudoun County.
How's that working out, living with your son and the next generation?
That's fine. That is fine. Because we go opposites, kind of. Like, I leave at, you know, 5 o'clock in the morning or something to 5 in the morning. When I come home, he's basically gone, and I go to bed, and I don't see him till maybe day off or something.
And you trade the baby back and forth? Is that the deal?
Right. I get off about 12:30, depending on whether I have my little one or not, as to what I do for the day. She waits up for her dad, and he takes over.
Yeah, tell me about her. She's 5 years old, right?
Oh, my goodness, yes. She's 5 years old. She's Zoe Denise. Every question in the book she can ask you. We watch the news together. Meemaw, what does that mean? What is that, Meemaw? She's smart as a whip.
Are you happy? Is life good?
Life's good. I can't complain. We have some ups and downs.
Yeah.
You know, I just take one day at a time.
So Gail's doing all right, living with her son Kevin and on her pension and savings from all those years at USAA, although she is hoping to get a raise soon. But thanks in part to her paychecks from Royal Farms, she is also able to see the world.
I've been so many places, I don't know. Alaska, Mediterranean, Panama Canal.
Oh, wow.
And South Africa. We're getting ready to go to Greece in September.
When you were a kid, did you ever imagine that you would have gone to South Africa and Greece and through the Panama Canal?
No. I truly wouldn't. But when I was a kid, or older kid, I guess I'll say, my mom liked to travel. So she always said, don't forget to travel in life. Life's too short. Don't stay in one spot.
And in a way, that's why you're working at Royal Farms, because your mom said, don't forget to travel.
Mm-hmm. I guess I'd just like my mom.
So you've been working all your life, right?
Pretty much, yeah.
How much longer are you going to keep on working?
I guess until my body says no, or I'm just tired. Can't tell you. But you know when you're tired of something.
It's interesting. It you don't sound like a person who gets tired, I guess.
When I got that grandbaby, I get tired.
Do you think Zoe Denise is going to have to work as hard as you did?
Her job probably would be different. I think she will go to college. Just hope I'm around to see that.
I'm pretty sure you will be.
Me too.
So that was Gail. She works part-time at a Royal Farms convenience store in Loudoun County, Virginia. Coming up on the program tomorrow.
My understanding of education was you went to college to get a good job, in parentheses, whatever good job means.
The 10th installment of our 10-person look at the American labor force. Two words, people. Chlorinated chicken. Upon such a thing, the British-American trading relationship might well rest. Britain wants, nay, needs, a free trade deal with the United States now that it's put the European Union into its rearview mirror. But among the stumbling blocks? Yep. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore is on the poultry desk.
The problem with chlorinated chicken, it turns out, is not the chlorine at all. It's what the chlorine represents. David Bowles is with the RSPCA. It's an animal welfare organization in the UK.
In America, the standards for many farm animals, including poultry, are much, much lower than they are in the UK, and particularly in how they clean the sheds, which is why the chicken have to be washed in chlorine or other disinfectant.
Tom Super is with the U.S. National Chicken Council. He agrees this isn't about chlorine. Only 10% of processing plants in the U.S. use chlorine to disinfect chicken meat. But he says it's not about standards either.
This issue has always been about politics and protectionism. Our safety standards and our welfare standards, among the best in the world, we're the most efficient producer of chicken.
U.S. chicken is produced in a more industrial way than British and European chicken, and it is a lot cheaper. If U.S. producers got access to the U.K. market as part of a free trade deal, British producers would suffer. But according to the Peterson Institute's Gary Huffbauer, the U.K. has another problem, the European Union.
The EU does not want to see inroads into their chicken defenses by the U.K.
The U.K. wants a trade deal with the EU. The EU says fine, but you can't accept U.S. chicken. The U.K. also wants a trade deal with the U.S., and the U.S. is saying, accept our chicken, which is leaving Britain in a very difficult position. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Coming up.
We used to have, 10 million sheep. We used to have 4 million goats.
Sheeps and goats and textiles? Oh, my. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is off 123 points today, 0.4%, 26,957. The NASDAQ gained 15 points, hence the mixed music, a 10th percent there, 89.80. The S&P 500 off 11 points, about 0.3%, 31.16. Delta Airlines down 2.5% today. The airline announced it's cutting the number of flights between the U.S. and South Korea. Video conferencing software company Zoom dimmed a 10th percent, but it's been up hard the past couple of days. Video conferencing, better than face-to-face meetings, right? TJX, the parent company of TJ Maxx, spruced up 7.1% today. JCPenney rolled up 4.7%. Beyond Meat rose 2.3% today. Starbucks announced its Canadian stores are going to start selling the firm's plant-based breakfast sandwich next week. Starbucks dipped 1.8%. Dunkin' Brands, parent of Dunkin' Donuts, slid 2.9% today. Bonds rose, yield on the 10-year Treasury note, get this, down to 1.33%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. The Centers for Disease Control has some pretty straightforward advice about COVID-19. Wash your hands a lot. No, you don't need to wear a mask if you're not sick. Oh, and stay home if you're sick, would you? Straightforward, yes. Simple, no, because for a whole lot of American workers, that last bit of counsel, stay home, is way, way easier said than done. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has that one.
Scott Marana has taken one sick day in the last 15 years. Not that he hasn't been sick on other days. Twice in the last couple months, he's powered through nasty colds at work, taking lots of precautions, of course, because he works at a hospital in Vail, Colorado, where he manages imaging systems in an operating room.
I kind of feel like even if I am sick, I need to be there to make sure that these surgeries go smoothly, because I'm the only one who does what I do.
Like a lot of Americans, he feels like he has no choice, and that's a problem.
U.S. workplaces are nowhere near ready to contain a coronavirus outbreak.
Karen Scott is with MIT's Institute for Work and Employment Research.
Our system isn't really set up for people to get sick at all.
She points to the H1N1 flu in 2009, when Penn State estimated a third of sickened workers reported to the job despite showing symptoms, causing the disease to spread to about 7 million more people. The U.S. does not insure any paid sick time, leaving about a third of workers without any sick days, and an even bigger share of service workers who interact with the public and handle food.
So basically, they have to choose between risking losing their job and their own health or that of their families.
Ruth Milkman is a labor sociologist at the City University of New York and says things are improving. 11 states and several more cities now require paid sick leave. But she says even workers that have it frequently don't use it.
You know, they get the kind of not so hidden message from their employer that even if they're entitled to paid sick time, it's really better if they come in.
A recent survey from Accountemps found 90% of professionals have gone into work sick. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Look for something new the next time your Uber pulls up. The company has done a deal to put ads on the roofs of some of the cars that the service uses. It is, yes, obviously, a money-making move for a company that was notorious for burning through venture capital while never making any actual profit. Uber is publicly traded now, still not turning a profit, in case you were wondering. And if it's turning to ads, one can only wonder what younger startups are doing when venture capital money dries up. Marketplace's Jasmine Garst reports.
Uber, Lyft, Snapchat, companies that have become ubiquitous but rarely, if ever, turn a profit. And they became household names because of venture capital funding. Some have crashed pretty spectacularly, like WeWork, MoviePass, and Blue Apron, a company that delivers meal kits to people's homes. Those companies attracted hundreds of millions in venture cash.
Because you have the hope of cashing out before it bursts.
Vivek Wadhwa is a professor at Carnegie Mellon University. Back in 2015, Blue Apron pulled in $135 million in venture funding. Blue Apron is now seen as a Silicon Valley cautionary tale. It went public in 2017. Today, because of declining sales, it's considered a sinking ship. Professor Eric Gordon from the University of Michigan says while venture capital fundamentally supports innovation, that money can also spoil companies.
You can spend tons of it to force growth. Once you go public, you can't spend $4 to produce $2 of revenue.
But Gene Munster at Loop, a venture capital firm, warns about putting all startup companies in the same bag.
There are some companies that should be held to a high standard of profitability at a very early stage because they are not in these massively transformative markets. That would be Blue Apron, for example, or MoviePass.
And when venture capital money dries up, startups have limited options. Sell, get loan money, go public and risk fizzling, or shut down altogether. I'm Jasmine Garst for Marketplace.
Texas is an oil state. The Permian Basin, Houston refineries, all of that. Also, though, cattle. Lots of them, more than any other state, in fact, by a bunch. But not all that long ago, Texas was a sheep state, too, and goats. In the middle of the 20th century, Texas dominated in wool and in mohair. Much of that industry is gone now, but as the Texas Standard's Michael Marks reports, not all of it.
Inside the Marathon Basin wool mill, about 280 miles southeast of El Paso, Seth Warnock adjusts the gears of a spinner, a machine that converts wool into usable yarn.
It's kind of loud and everything moves, so keep your hands to yourself.
He turns it on. But then, a strand of wool gets tangled in the machine. Warnock is used to complications like this. Although the mill is only 3 years old, his family has raised sheep on the same land since 1829. His wife Bonnie helps out, but mostly he works alone, tinkering in a tan shed in the West Texas desert.
We built the building, poured the floor, bought the equipment, moved it in, and then learned how to run it.
Warnock sorts out the problem with the spinner in short order, turns it back on, and soon, the machine threads yard upon yard of soft, clean, off-white yarn onto spools. Processing wool appears to be fairly automated, but it's difficult, requires a lot of attention to detail, and the machines can cause injuries. Don Brown is also familiar with its ins and outs.
There's all the maintenance of the machines, there's all the supplies, and then there's the safety factor.
Brown runs another wool mill. Actually, it's the only other wool mill in Texas. Independence Wool and Mohair, 90 miles northwest of Houston. Her family has deep roots in the industry, but her first career was as a gynecologist. She took up knitting as part of rehab for a shoulder injury, and that started her down the path to making the mill her full-time job. It's a profession that was once much more common in Texas. There were about 24 mills started in the late 1800s. By the mid-20th century, they were dwindling.
We used to have, 10 million sheep. We used to have 4 million goats across Central and West Texas.
Now there are fewer than a million of each. In the late 1980s, Texas produced over $30 million worth of wool and about the same amount of mohair per year. Now, it's down to about $3 million apiece. Over time, synthetic material replaced wool. Processors in places like China and South Africa produced fiber more cheaply. And Texas changed.
Ranches are sold. The younger generation goes off to do other things. There's all kind of external factors that influence the industry. Now it's so small. You don't want it to go away.
That's a big reason why she and Warnock spend so many hours picking cedar twigs out of wool, spinning yarn, fixing machines. It's certainly not a get-rich-quick scheme. Warnock is just now turning a profit, mostly by selling yarn online for around $20 a skein through the craft site Etsy.
And it was 10 months from the day we launched it till we made our first sale. You had to have some grit to stay with it.
It's a lifestyle that fewer and fewer Texans feel connected to as the state's rural population shrinks. Repairing that disconnect is part of Don Brown's mission with the mill. She started an apprentice program and gives lectures around Texas about the sheep and goat industry.
If you can impart that to a younger generation to be proud of their heritage, be proud of their land, maybe they're going to stay. Maybe they're going to come back. I did.
She can't single-handedly revive the industry, but she can search for the next person to keep its wheels spinning. In Austin, I'm Michael Marks for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today for the more hirsute of you, facial hair department. The Centers for Disease Control has a chart. Should you find yourself in a situation in the near future where wearing a face mask would be advisable, it's a chart, pictographs mostly, that tells you what kinds of facial hair are not really compatible with maximum respiratory protection. This is a tough one to do on the radio because pictures, but thankfully they name the different kinds and styles of facial adornments. Clean shaven is, of course, best for maximum protection. Walrus, painter's brush, and chevron mustaches, whatever they are also acceptable. Mutton chops and something called a hulihi are no good. Same for Van Dyke's, Circle Beards, and French Forks. Number one, who knew facial hair had all these names, right? Was that just me? Also, number two, you got to see it to believe it. We've got the chart at marketplace.org. Okay, we're done. The Dow off 123 points today, a mere 0.4%. The NASDAQ was actually up 15 points, 0.1%. S&P 500 shed 11 points, 0.3% there. Our media production team includes Sarah Berger, Robin Edgar, Drew Jostat, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Jay Siebold, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.